Degrees in Kenosha, 6 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill is minus 4. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Two interesting interviews coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD. In the first, we're going to be learning a bit about the so-called Mediterranean diet, which is one of the most popular diets, especially among those suggested or prescribed by physicians. It's a great way to get healthy and to lose weight. And the author of a new book suggests some ways in which the Mediterranean diet can be combined with vegetarianism or veganism to even greater effect. In part two of today's morning show, at about 20 after the hour, we'll be hearing more from Mark Moran from Antiques Roadshow, who is coming to the Kenosha Public Museum for a benefit this Saturday for the Friends of the Public Museum, in which you can bring an antique from your home and have it appraised. We'll hear all about that coming up on today's morning show. Before we get to the interviews, a reminder that the Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Membership Fund Drive is underway, and each and every contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio translates into support for this station, WGTD, on a number of different levels. And of course, at this point in time, it is more important than ever that public radio listeners express their support in a very tangible way with a pledge of financial support. Please take a moment out of your day to call toll-free 1-888-202-2552, 1-888-202-2552. And as you speak to a friendly representative, volunteer from Wisconsin Public Radio and pledge your support, please make specific mention of the fact that you're a WGTD listener. And if you are as well, please mention that you're a fan of the morning show. Here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. And thank you for your support. One of the diets which is most often recommended by physicians, both for the sake of good health and for weight loss, is the Mediterranean diet. And one way that you can explore exactly what the Mediterranean diet is, and a way in which to, in a sense, take it a step further, is to read a new book called The Vegetarian Diet, the new and improved Mediterranean eating plan, which, in a sense, melds the Mediterranean diet with notions of vegetarianism or veganism. And the author is Juliana Hever, who has written The Complete Idiot's Guide to Plant-Based Nutrition. And perhaps you know her wellness talk show, What Would Juliana Do? And again, this book is called The Vegetarian Diet, published by Da Capo Press. Juliana Hever, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a really interesting book. And my own physician some time ago, for the purpose of helping me combat my high blood pressure and a couple of other health issues, had recommended to me the Mediterranean diet, which at that point in time I had never heard of. And of course, I've heard a lot about it now, and your book gives us a lot more information about it. First of all, you should maybe specify what we're talking about in terms of that whole region of the world and how we've come to even think of something as the Mediterranean diet.
Right, I was so fascinated by it. First of all, I love all of those regions and the cuisine of that region, but I was fascinated by the fact that the Mediterranean diet is considered the gold standard in the research, whereby I've also noticed that with plant-based diets, we've seen things like reversal of type 2 diabetes, reversal of coronary artery disease. So I wanted to rectify why are they both so, amazingly successful. So yes, I dug really deep all the way in ancient Greece and all the way through the whole history of how the Mediterranean diet started to kind of get its name, and how basically this is what started the connection or the recognition that there is indeed a link between cardiovascular disease, chronic disease, and what we eat. So there was a lot of history there, and it was a very fascinating evolution. And I really, my overall conclusion, one of the main reasons I think the Mediterranean diet is so effective is because it is indeed a whole food plant-based diet.
In other words, that we on the Mediterranean diet, you're really placing great emphasis on that, contrary to what the practices of so many modern Americans running around and eating a whole lot of processed foods and others that just don't give us the goodness of whole food, of whole food and plant-based food.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a whole culture of sitting down and enjoying your food and eating directly from nature, stuff that we've grown, you know, and stuff that, you know, we're just like getting back to our roots of how we ate traditionally and eating, a broad variety of foods that came from the garden and that you made yourself and you cooked and you took the time to cook in the classic Mediterranean era when they were, it's basically really initially studied in the early 60s. People were taking time, hours, making their food, and they had very little cooking equipment, but they spend the day, cooking and putting love and soul into it, and then they would all sit down together and enjoy a meal, and there's so many wonderful traditions that we've kind of lost in our frenetic setting, but it's kind of exciting, the idea to just at least try to incorporate some of those habits and some of those eating patterns into our modern life.
So explain to especially the uninitiated listener what the distinction is between what we might think of as kind of a more normal just vegetarian diet or vegan diet versus specifically the Mediterranean diet. What does the Mediterranean diet sort of underscore or emphasize that maybe another kind of vegetarianism, for instance, might not?
That's such a good question. You know, really, that's what I was looking at. So really it is that they ate mostly, they did incorporate a little bit of fish, a little bit of meat, but I don't have the number in front of me, like 6 or 7% of their total calories. You know, whereas if you look at the standard American diet, it's an enormous amount of calories. People are taking in so many animal products and definitely the processed foods, which didn't even exist at that time. But when you think about comparing a vegetarian diet to a Mediterranean diet, the only difference really would be the type of cuisine, because essentially the Mediterranean diet is it's a vegan diet, and without even olive oil and all that, I even took the oil out to make it even more wholesome. And so it really is just that the flavors, like the 66 recipes that are in the book, are just Mediterranean cuisine, you know. And there's like about 18 countries that border the Med. So there's stuff from places from food and cuisines that are so unique from the Middle East versus Italy and Greece, and so there's just all these different types of flavors that are would really encompass the definition of vegetarian versus vegetarian.
One thing I want to make sure we take a little time to do is talk about the really interesting information you give in Chapter 4 of the book, which is called The Veg 10, Basics of the Vegetarian Diet, in which you are giving us some really good advice, and actually 10 little items of advice about how to do this in the healthiest kind of way. And I want to make sure we at least talk about several of these, beginning with the first one, which is pick proper packaging. What is it about packaging that might mislead us or lead us to make some poor choices?
Yes, this is one of my favorite parts of the book because, you know, people are always so in a quest for a certain nutrient, especially like one of the most common ones is, oh, where do you get your protein? I need my protein. I need my protein. But we don't eat protein. We eat food. We eat whole food. And if you look at where the protein is, there's protein in all whole foods and there's protein in animal products. But if you look at the difference between the two groups of food, like a protein that's coming packaged with plants, inside of a plant food, you've got thousands and thousands of phytochemicals, which we know have wonderful beneficial effects on our human health. And it's also got tons of fiber, and it's got, which again is another important food group. I think fiber and phytochemicals are the two most important food groups out there, and those are only available in plants. You're getting all these wonderful vitamins, minerals, fibers, antioxidants, water, all this wonderful stuff packaged with that protein in the plant. Now compare that to the protein that you get in an animal product. Not only do you have zero fiber or zero phytochemicals, but you also have much fewer vitamins and minerals. And on the flip side of that, in the animal products, you have things that are health damaging, which we do not have in plant foods, such as saturated fat, heme iron, IGF-1, all these hormones and steroids that are naturally occurring. And these things have deleterious effects on our body. So if you look at the packaging, yes, you're getting protein there, but you can get the same protein from plants alongside with all of these health-promoting nutrients that are going to make you more resilient to the most chronic diseases, the diseases that are killing the majority of the world now, versus, you know, you can get your protein. It's like it's picking the it's picking the packaging of the entire food and looking at the entire food instead of just looking at one nutrient.
Right. In a sense, sort of towards that end, one of your 10 bits of advice is revel in the rainbow. Revel in the rainbow. Explain to our listeners the rainbow to which you are referring here.
Yes, I love saying, especially to children, I'm so sorry, I'm still waking up here in Los Angeles. The rainbow represents, when you get it from food, not from processed foods like candies, but when you get real rainbow-colored foods, every single one of those colors represent different phytochemicals. So, like, the green is, like, chlorophyll, which is very oxygenating in the blood, and it's very health-promoting in the blood and alkalizing. And then the reds can represent a class of carotenoids, which are powerful antioxidants that fight against chronic disease. So if you look at every single color of the rainbow, those pigments, the colors themselves, represent very powerful and helpful, like medicinal types of nutrients. And so you want to get a broad range of them, and you want to get every single color every day. And I always say, like, I double dare you to get a double rainbow every day. You know, I try to get two of each color every day and just keep it colorful so that you're covering your bases.
Real quick, you talk also about favoritizing fats. And of course, it's not that we avoid fat altogether, but we have to be careful about the kinds of fats we take into our body. What is your advice here?
Right. There's so much controversy on fat. And I really dug into the fat literature. I probably read hundreds of scientific articles on types of fatty acids. Like, I wanted to know, why is it olive oil that's the reason? And is it, you know, what, all that stuff in the fish acids, the essential fatty acids in fish versus the essential fatty acids you can find in plants. So I do this whole crazy in-depth look at fats. And the conclusion that I made is that there are people that do very low-fat diets and are very successful, and there are people that do very, like, moderate fats. Like, the Mediterranean diet is classically about 36% of calories from fat, which we would consider a high-fat diet, but they got them from healthier fats than what the standard American diet is. So essentially the conclusion there is that it's not how much fat per se, it's more likely the quality of fat. So I recommend getting your fats from whole food sources, so no oils, because that's a processed food, getting it from whole wonderful nuts and seeds and olives and avocados, and getting just eating it from a whole food sources. It's very hard to get too much, and you're also going to make sure you're getting the right kinds of fats. You're going to balance out the types of essential fats that you need, and really just to favoritize those whole food sources.
Very good. And you do put in a good word for legumes. They evidently are a very important part of this picture as well.
Absolutely. I think the two most important food groups that are the most nutrient food groups on the planet that will provide so much nutrition and so much energy and all of the above are leafy greens and legumes. So beans, lentils, peas, they're so good in, like, folate, minerals and vitamins and tons of fiber, like all kinds of different fibers that are really heart healthy, immune system healthy. And I think I recommend having about 1.5 cups of legumes a day cooked, and then about 3 cups of leafy greens, both raw and cooked, because there's benefits to having raw and cooked a day. So 3 cups leafy greens, 1 to 1.5 cups of legumes a day, and that is one of the best habits you can get into.
Very good.
To really save your health.
I know I have to let you go. You have your kids to get off to school. One recipe you want to tell people about that will excite them about this book?
Oh my God, that's, you know, I love these recipes. This is how I eat, so I'm kind of proud of them. I did a lot of broad range, but I kind of favorited Italy. And so one of my favorite recipes is a cheesy smoky butternut squash pasta. So it's kind of like making a cheese sauce, and it's totally vegan. So it's made out of, you know, butternut squash, like roasted butternut squash, and some nutritional yeast that gives it a flavor, and a lot of, like, smoked paprika and a lot of flavors, hearty flavors. And then I baked that in, or I cooked that in with some pasta. I use gluten-free pasta, but you could use any whole grain pasta, and dip in some broccoli. And I always say that hummus should be a food group because I love hummus. And I, like I said, the legumes are so healthy, and it's a delicious way to get some legumes. So I have about two or three different hummus recipes in there that I that are my staples that I live on.
Again, the book is called The Vegetarian Diet, and it's written by Juliana Hever. Thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye. And it's 8:25. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. And here's part two. There's a very special event coming up this Saturday at the Kenosha Public Museum called What's It Worth? It's a Friends of the Museum event, an antiques appraisal event, and a very special expert is coming to town to oversee what promises to be a really exciting day at the museum. His name is Mark Moran, and perhaps you have seen him as a guest expert on PBS's Antiques Roadshow, or maybe have heard about the extensive work which he does. Mark Moran lives in Iola, Wisconsin, and does all kinds of events like this and has written extensively about antiques in a number of different ways in several different important antiques publications. And it's great to have an expert of his caliber coming to town to oversee Saturday's event, which begins at 10:30. And I'm really excited for us to have the opportunity to speak with Mark Moran about the work that he does and to give us a little better sense of exactly what's going to be happening Saturday at the museum. Again, What's It Worth? That event is coming up this Saturday, February 28th, beginning at 10:30 in the morning. Mark Moran, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's wonderful to be on.
Tell us, I should have looked at the map myself, tell us where Iola, Wisconsin is.
Well, you can't get there from here. I'm kidding. You know, Iola is a tiny little village of 1,301 people. It's in Waupaca County. It is in just about 20 minutes east of Stevens Point. That's the landmark that most people use to measure distance in this part of the world. So, just a short drive to Stevens Point in east central Wisconsin.
Wow. So not a short drive to Kenosha, but we appreciate you making the trip. I know that you have had this interest for some time, although it's not something you've done your lifelong, although, I mean, at least not professionally. It hasn't been your sole professional
right.
venture. But have you had, in a sense, nearly a lifelong interest in antiques or in one way or another? Or otherwise, when did this begin?
Well, it really started back in the 1970s, about 40 years ago, when I walked into an antique shop for the very first time. Being the oldest of 11 children, my parents didn't have any disposable income, so they didn't buy any antiques, they didn't buy collectibles, they didn't buy fine art. But I was surrounded by my father's paintings, and I was lucky enough to be able to, learn from his work and just kind of absorb this appreciation for proportion and color and form. By osmosis, I think I got a lot of my, at least initial antiques and art savvy from being around his artwork. So in the 1970s, started out as a collector in the 1980s. I became a part-time antique dealer. I was a newspaper man. I was for 30 years. I started out in working for the Press Gazette up in Green Bay, and then I spent most of my newspaper life at the Post Bulletin in Rochester, Minnesota. And I feel that experience as a newspaper man also informs a lot of what I do today. You know, tell a good story, tell it clearly and simply and honestly, and be entertaining. And that's what I try and do at my antique appraisal events. So in the 1980s, I was a part-time dealer. And then in the 90s, while still a newspaper man, I started writing antique reference books. And I wrote three books before I quit the newspaper business for good in 2002 to write antique reference books full-time. And I've written 27 books on various antiques and collectible categories. And so the funny thing is, all of the books that I wrote are now out of print. And so the books that I wrote on collectibles have themselves become collectible, which is not something that I ever anticipated.
Right. You began doing these events back in 2011.
Correct.
And I suppose that was kind of an interesting step for you to take after having mostly collected yourself and written about this. This is a different and sort of public venue that sort of takes this into a whole different and of course, very exciting arena. Tell us about making that move back in 2011.
Well, you know, it is a very exciting, you know, time, at least for professionally for me, because I just between you and me, I have more fun at my programs than just about anyone else who comes. So I'm a very lucky man in that way. In 2011, you're right, I started doing these programs because my employer, which was also my publisher, Krause Publications, it was just almost exactly 4 years ago now, they said, hey, Mark, thanks a lot. And, oh, by the way, don't let the door hit you on your way out. And good luck in what you want to do. So I was one of five people that was laid off that day. And, you know, the market for antiques and collectibles reference books had shrunk a lot. I think anyone who goes into a Barnes & Noble knows that what used to be a big section of racks of books on antiques and collectibles is now just one tiny little niche, maybe one shelf. So I went home and I thought, well, now what am I going to do? And I have all this knowledge that I have, you know, accumulated over the decades, and I have all these great contacts, and what am I going to do with all this knowledge? I used to say I was a walking compendium of useless knowledge. Now I had to make it useful knowledge. So I came up with this idea of doing antiques and collectibles appraisal events for libraries, historical societies, museums, senior communities, and the response was instant and enthusiastic. People just absolutely love the programs. And it's appraisal as theater. You know, an audience is always welcome. We sit around and we talk about history and origins and usage and values. And I have I use a 32-inch flat screen monitor that's hooked up to my laptop. And so people can see the websites that I use to consult. I subscribe to half a dozen different websites that give me up-to-date information on values. And so that's been a very, very popular part of the program. But I think the reason that these events have been so successful is that these people like the fact that this is not a shopping trip for me. I never offer to buy or sell on a commission at any of my programs. And I think people like that. They know it's not a shopping trip. I'm not there looking to pick up a bargain and you know, turn around and make money on it. But there's nothing wrong with that. That's what an antique dealer does. I am not an antique dealer. I'm an appraiser. And so these events that I do and the house calls that I do are all that I do. I don't buy and sell anymore.
I was just on your website and looking on your calendar, and it looks like every single weekend all the way through, well, the next several months, every single weekend you are someplace else doing events like the one you're going to be doing this Saturday at the Kenosha Public Museum.
Yep, and you know, it's a wonderful, the response, as I said, has just been amazing. And you're right, the weekends are always booked first, and right up to, from now right up to Thanksgiving, I think pretty much every weekend has something going on. And you know, I'm so grateful for the response that these events have had. And you know, the other side of the coin too is that when folks find out that I'm coming to town, people who have big things or fragile things or a lot of things, ask about home visits. And I do make lots of house calls. I did a program it's a couple years ago now for the Friends of the Racine Public Library, and the response was just overwhelming. I had 14 house calls in addition to about a six-hour antique appraisal event at the library. So there has been a pent-up demand for someone to do this sort of thing, and you know, who is not dealing with you know, banks and, you know, trust offices and lawyers and law firms and things like that, folks with stuff. And sometimes folks find out that what they have is valuable or special or rare. A lot of the time what they have is just stuff, and a lot of them appreciate that, just knowing. I mean, most of the people that I talk to in my programs and on my house calls don't care if it's something rare or valuable. They just want to know, especially in the case of something that has come down through the family, through the generations, they just want to know if the story's true, what they've heard all their lives about, you know, Uncle Harry's rocking chair or Aunt Martha's, you know, table lamp. And sometimes it is, and sometimes the story grows in the telling over the years. But you know, that's all part of the fun, too. Mm.
We're speaking with Mark Moran, an antiques appraiser, a very highly regarded one, who is coming to Kenosha this Saturday, the 28th of February, for an appraisal event which will occur at the Kenosha Public Museum. And it's an opportunity for people to come and have something that they own appraised. Tell us a little bit about the logistics of how this works. I know that it's necessary for people to register ahead of time. And so tell us a little bit more about what people pay, and if they pay, then what, in a sense, they are going to get in exchange, how the day is going to work.
Sure. You know, many of my events, the hosts just pay me a flat fee to come in. But in the case of a fundraiser like we're having at the museum, each appraisal is $15. And a third of all the money that comes in goes back to the host. And I've done events with well over 100 appraisals. It takes about 8 hours, you know, to do these. So, as I mentioned, it's appraisal as theater. People can come in, sit down, and you know, listen to other folks. There are three types of people who come to my programs. The first is the folks who come and they get their appraisal, and they have a good time, and then they go home. And the second is they come and they get their appraisal, and they have a good time, and they sit for an hour or two or three or even more, and just listen to and learn about, you know, other folks' treasures. And then the third group is they come to their program, and they get their appraisal, and they have a good time, and they go home and get more stuff. this happens at every single program that I do, and I love the fact that you know, when people get to the event, they think, oh gosh, I should have brought, you know, this, or I should have brought that. And so, you know, if, you know, time permitting, you know, I'll stay as long as people have things for me to look at, this coming Saturday. So, you know, I have to thank my friend, Karen Aid, who originally contacted me and put together, the plans for our program. So, I'm looking forward to finally meeting Karen and seeing all the folks in Kenosha. I should say that last year we had a great program at the public library, and I think it was as a result of that the nice folks at the museum contacted me.
Very good. I examined the long list that's on your website of the kinds of items that people can bring to you, and then almost more interesting than that was the list of items you are not interested in appraising. And I'm just intrigued that it's a very varied list. You are not interested in appraising weapons or Nazi memorabilia or beanie
Correct.
Babies
yes.
or fine jewelry. And we should probably talk about all of those, but
sure.
I mean, I think we can probably, to some extent, maybe understand your reluctance to be appraising weapons. But tell us, is that more of a philosophical thing, or the fact that is an area of appraisal in which you're not particularly well versed, or
it's Yeah, it's the second. It's not a language that I speak. And really, that's what we do as appraisers. We learn to speak the language of various collecting categories. And guns and swords and knives are just not something I've known about. It's not something that I've ever been interested in. But, over the years, you don't know how much you know until someone presents you with an object and, a puzzle or a question or a challenge. And so over the years, I just have not been in a position to learn a lot about weapons, guns and swords and knives and that sort of thing. People I used to see from time to time, World War II era, usually brought back by returning GIs, Nazi memorabilia, and I was able to appraise it, looking at comparable examples, and usually these are banners and flags and helmets and things of that nature. But I finally said, this represents a part of our history that was, a brutal and awful time. And I just decided that I wanted to exclude those things from my programs. And so that was a philosophical decision on my part. Leg hold traps also, that's just my point of view. I don't think that those are appropriate, for my program. They represent an era when subsistence hunting was the only way for people to survive. Those days are long gone. So I don't do traps. Fine jewelry, that's a language I don't speak. Coins and currency. And yes, you mentioned Beanie Babies. So that's a pretty eclectic list of excluded items. Everything else, pretty much, I can handle to one degree or another. And if I see something that I don't know what it is, or I don't have an idea what the value is, having been in the business so long, I'm able to reach out to my friends in the trade, to my many contacts. I was doing a program a couple weeks ago down in Normal, Illinois, my first visit down there. We had a fabulous time doing a program for the Normal Public Library Foundation. Had a packed event, and one of the nice folks brought in these two glass discs that they had holes in the middle, and then also kind of little vent holes on the side. They were hand-blown. They were clearly very, very old, from the 19th century. She didn't know what they were. She had taken them to antique dealers all around the area. No one could tell her what they were. I looked at them. I didn't know what they were. But I took a picture of them at the program, and I sent them off to my good friend Jeff Evans, who has an auction company out in Mount Crawford, Virginia. And Jeff got right back to me, and he said, these are hand-blown 19th century breast shields that women who were nursing would wear, to control the flow of milk when they weren't.
Wow.
Nursing. And so, yeah, I mean, you can look it up online, glass breast shields, 19th century, hand blown. They are worth almost nothing. they are just interesting little oddities, but in terms of financial value, very little. So after years and years of trying to figure out what these objects were, the nice lady was very grateful when I got back to her and said, here's what they are.
Of course, a lot of people have watched PBS's Antiques Roadshow and tend to think about events like this in terms of the big reveal of
the wow moment.
Right, the great value that something's worth thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. I suppose that is a relatively rare occurrence, and do you want people to sort of tamp down those kind of maybe unrealistic expectations about what is most likely to transpire? Or does that happen often enough that people should go ahead and harbor such hopes?
I don't want to tamp down anyone's desire to have a rare or valuable object. know, I like to say that if 10,000 people show up at an Antiques Roadshow event, and ultimately 10 of them get their treasures featured on the program, those are the right odds. You know, the odds of someone having something rare or valuable or incredibly unusual are about 1,000 to 1. But it happens every day, and it happens on a regular basis at my appraisal events. The one that comes to mind is a couple years ago, I was doing a program in Prescott, Wisconsin, over on the Mississippi River, just across from Hastings, Minnesota, if people know that part of the world. And a gentleman came into the program, and he had a painting that he had bought at a yard sale for $5. And it was an original illustrator art painting of from a 1950s pinup calendar. So it was girly art, as they call it. It showed a beautiful young woman in a negligee, leaving very little to the imagination. And she was trying to replace an electrical fuse. And of course, she's illuminated in the light of a little flashlight nearby. And so it was a very sweet, sexy, it would have been in a calendar that would have hung in only the finest gas station repair shops, back in the 1950s. And the artist who did it, Harry Ackman, was a pretty well-regarded, pinup artist in the 1950s and early 60s. So the gentleman at the program bought this painting for $5, brought it into the event. I told him I thought it was worth $10,000. And he looked at me like I had two heads. And I said, well, there's only one way to know for sure. You have to put it out on the market. You have to let the market decide what it's worth. Sell it at auction. That's the only way to do it. And so he consigned it to auction. He sent it to Cincinnati to be sold by an auction company, Cowan's, one of my Antiques Roadshow colleagues. Wes Cowan runs that company. And this was in 2013 that it went up for auction. And we were on the road with Roadshow. We were in Kansas City or Knoxville or someplace like that. And Wes came over to me, and he had his iPad with him. He said, hey, look at this. And the painting had just sold at his auction for $16,000.
Wow.
And so I was thrilled. Wes was thrilled. The owner of the painting, who bought it for $5, was thrilled. So, it was just one of those, wonderful things that happens, and it happens every single day. It's just that sometimes it takes a while before we, are able to realize what it's really worth.
Hmm. Talk about those moments when somebody comes to you with an item that is of precious value to them, and about which they maybe harbor hopes that it's valuable in other ways as well, but need to be told, no, I'm sorry, this is actually just a cheap copy of such and such.
Yeah.
Or this is something that there are just so many of them out there that, in fact, this isn't precious in that respect at all. I suspect that one of the challenges in doing these kind of events is how you are going to handle a moment like that, and handle sometimes the delicate feelings of people with some of their most prized possessions.
Yep, exactly. Well, I've learned over the years how to be as gentle and diplomatic and as possible when I have to break that kind of news. And it happens pretty frequently, someone will come in and say, well, my great-grandmother told me to hold on to this because it was really, really valuable. And my response to that usually is, I wish that I had gotten to know great grandma and had been able to talk to her and try and understand why she thought a certain object, was valuable then, and would continue to go up in value. The funny thing is that in the last 20 to 30 years, and I know that viewers of Antiques Roadshow hear this over and over again, and it's absolutely true. Values for many antiques and collectibles have declined significantly in the last two or three decades. And part of the reason for that is a change in collecting temperament. You know, the younger people are not as interested in the objects that you know, folks started collecting in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And the other component of that is that the quality of the reproductions now is so good. You know, if someone wants a look in their house, something that you know, fits in with their decor and looks nice and presentable and attractive, and you know, they can go to a million places online. They can go to Pottery Barn or Pier One or Ethan Allen and spend more money than what the actual antique would cost. But there's no hunt there. It's instant gratification. And you know, for me and for many people who got into antiques in the 1970s, the hunt was as big, if not a bigger part of the collecting process than the finding. In fact, sometimes when you found something, it was actually anticlimactic to all the fun you had, you know, along the way, going to auctions and flea markets and garage sales and meeting all these crazy people who share your passion for collecting and talking to antique dealers, appraisers, other collectors, auctioneers. It's an amazing, you know, subculture in this country of that I think you know, is maybe fading away. I mean, I used to say that the values for objects was a pendulum. It swings one way and it'll swing back. I don't think we'll ever see some of the values that we saw in the late 90s, and that was really the peak for many, many collecting areas in terms of value.
Let's talk for a moment about Beanie Babies. Only because, I mean, again, that's one of the items that people should not bring to this event on Saturday. I only mention it because I'm pretty sure what's at the heart of that, and I know a lot of really intelligent people who unfortunately got kind of swindled into thinking that they could buy Beanie Babies by the hundreds and bankroll their children's college education. And it seems like that is a cautionary tale on how a lot of people, at that time at least, really badly misunderstood the whole notion of collectability and how an object is likely or unlikely to gain value over time. And, I mean, just the mathematics of it. If you have thousands, maybe millions of people buying right. Beanie Babies and collecting them by its very nature, those are not going to increase in value. They're going to plummet in value. And, of course, that's exactly what the situation is. Is it as simple as that? And how is it that so many people kind of misunderstood that?
Well, I think that, you know, from time to time you get these contemporary collectible categories that get very, very hot for a while, but then by their nature, they're going to get very, very cold ultimately. And so Beanie Babies is a classic example, but also think back about Cabbage Patch dolls. You know, to a generation or two before that, there were Hummel figurines and Precious Moment figurines. And Yadro, the statues and figurines made by the Spanish company called Yadro, all of those contemporary collectibles had communities of very enthusiastic collectors grow up around them. They weren't made as collectibles. They had a community that grew up, and so. There are companies that saw that and thought, well, maybe we can, you know, get in on this collectible craze by producing collector plates that have, you know, Norman Rockwell images on them, or, you know, scenes from Gone with the Wind, or, you know, there were just an endless number of these. But unfortunately, you know, they all call these limited editions, but they're really only limited by the length of time before the machine that makes them breaks down. That's the only thing that limits them. So in the 1970s and 80s, especially, collector plates were just huge. And then, of course, in the 90s, you had the Beanie Babies as well. So these you know, collector areas, contemporary areas, are really, you know, more about pop culture than they are about long-term collectible value. Now, who knows what's going to happen in 100 or 200 years? I have a feeling that especially in the case of Beanie Babies, you're not going to see much upward movement. I'm sure that there will be some rare ones. There always are. But in general, they just, you know, it was like printing money. And the more money you print, the more devalued it becomes. And that's what happened with the Beanie Babies. They just kept making them, producing them. And you're right. I mean, there's a very famous documentary you might be able to see online of this family who thought that they were investing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to help put their children through college. And now they have a house full of thousands and thousands of Beanie Babies that are almost worthless.
I mean, I can think of several people I know in my own life, otherwise exceptionally intelligent people who fell into the same trap. And on the other hand, for some people, Beanie Babies were just something fun and a relatively inexpensive way to collect something. I suppose it's even a sadder story when people are maybe spending lots and lots of money on much more expensive items in the mistaken notion that someday these will be extremely valuable. It almost seems like part of the equation is what gains in value is the things that at the time it never occurs to anybody to keep them.
That's true. Ephemera is what we call it. Things that were often, you know, purchased, used, and then thrown away. And so things that survive that process as ephemera can be very collectible today. Advertising cards, you know, comes to mind. Posters, things like that. But, you know, my advice is the advice that all good, you know, antiques-related people stick with, and that is buy something you love. You know, buy the best example that you can find, and upgrade your collection. A collection isn't just an accumulation of objects; it's a changing, you know, association of things and feelings and understanding. And the more you know, and we know this from years and years of experience, the more people know about a specific collecting area, the more comfortable they are spending money. If they're spending money from the standpoint of knowledge rather than ignorance, they're going to be more confident in their buying power. But you know what? It's quality. As long as people buy quality items, they don't have to worry about, you know, whether or not they're going to appreciate the best examples of anything out there: glass, ceramics, artwork, furniture, toys. If you buy the best example that you can, you know, you won't go wrong.
Mark Moran is an antiques appraiser, and he is coming to Kenosha this Saturday at the invitation of the Friends of the Museum. And so this is a fundraising event for the Friends of the Kenosha Public Museum, Saturday beginning at 10:30. And if you would like information on registering for Saturday's event, you should contact the Kenosha Public Museum by calling 653-4140, 653-4140. Tomorrow on the morning show, a conversation from the archives 10 years ago with author Blair Tyndall, her memoir called Mozart in the Jungle, which has been adapted into a television series and a much-discussed series, I should say, which has just been renewed for another season. On Monday's morning show, I'm excited to speak with local author Carl Swanson about his latest book, which is about the dramatic events in Selma. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, at 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. As we approach 9 o'clock, we want to remind you about Wisconsin Public Radio's Fund Drive. And your contribution is very, very crucial, particularly in this current landscape in which some very significant budget cuts are looming for Wisconsin Public Radio and public television. And those are budget cuts that are going to affect all of us who are involved in public radio. So your support has never been more crucial, more critical than it is right now. So I would urge you to...